Hey, have you ever met somebody that you thought was absolutely fascinating? You wanted to learn more about that person's story and all the amazing things they've done? Well, stick around. I've got somebody on my show you're going to love to hear from. Hello, and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy, and today I'm with Jerry Ellsworth, who I've had a chance to know for, about 10 years now.
I know. It's been a while. Well, thanks for having me on.
And Jerry, as I say, was one of these people I had met a few years back that I thought was absolutely fascinating, and I love what she's accomplished and the stuff she does and things like that. I just want to share that with you because I think there's probably something you can learn in terms of things you can accomplish, breaking typical role models, and the challenges of entrepreneurship. Exactly. As well as maybe, soldering or doing welding in your own backyard and other props.
Home chemistry,
yeah. Blowing things up, etc. So anyway, welcome.
Oh, thanks. Where do you want to go with this? I'm such a strange bird. Not exactly cybersecurity or any of that. Although I have done some security stuff on chips, so we could get to that at some point.
You could get to that. Well, first of all, a little bit of background. I mean, where'd you come from and how we get in the place where you are now with us?
Oh, yeah. Well, most people that are a little off center were raised a little bit different. So I was, I grew up in rural Oregon, a really tiny town by a single father who treated me like an adult from a very early age because we had to run the household together. I got interested in electronics and computers at a super early age. As soon as I could get into his tool chest, I started taking apart all my toys and everything else, including the VCR, getting into lots of trouble. But a very supportive father who recognized that I was kind of an inventor at heart. So, he owned a business in town. He actually put a box out in front of his business and said, "Bring your broken electronics." So much of my childhood was just ripping apart gadgets, like a dirty old toaster to broken tape decks and stuff like that. And eventually started figuring out how to build stuff on my own. I was a bit of a tortured kid in school because I was weird and nerdy. So I went through weird phases in school. And probably the most interesting one is I was the picked on kid. But then I found after clobbering this bully one time in the face with a big heavy book, I got this new respect when I came back to school. And then I went down this whole bad girl phase, gothy, trying to do everything to boost my persona of being crazy and wild. Got into racing cars and building chassis. So I used to build my own quarter mile dirt track oval cars. And I was a professional race car driver right out of high school. I ended up dropping out of high school because I was making so much money building and racing cars.
Don't try this at home.
No, and don't take my path. It's not the easiest path. But yeah, that was exciting. And eventually I got my head screwed on straight. It's I don't have to be this naughty kid all the time and doing wild and crazy stuff. And, after, maturing a little bit, I'm okay, I can go back to my kind of nicer self with an edge. And in the 90s, I opened a chain of retail computer stores. Windows 95 had just come out. It was a really good time to be helping people get onto the internet. Mm-hmm. And I ended up being quite successful with those stores through the 90s until year 2000. So if you were older...
It wasn't probably Y2K that blew you away, though, was it?
No, it was actually directly related to Y2K, but in an interesting way. So if you're old enough to remember, Y2K, everyone was spooked. Your computers are going to burst into flame midnight, when that clock rolls over, which was not a thing. All of us in the computer industry knew it was not going to be too big of a deal.
I ended up on the Howard Stern show.
What?
Talking about that, because they're asking about, what's going to happen in Y2K? Do we have to worry about all these hackers? And I said, the really good ones are going to be out partying on New Year's Eve because they can get into your computers any day they want.
I actually slept through it. I remember, just waking up past midnight and I'm oh, all right, well, we're still alive. No, but the thing that wiped out my business in 2000 is there was this gold rush to upgrade all of the computers. So businesses were upgrading, consumers were upgrading. I was just raking in the money on each of my stores. And it's almost what happened after COVID too. So I have some insight on that as well. But everyone upgraded, and then no one needed upgrades. And then we started hemorrhaging money like crazy. And I made some like really naive mistakes. Like things were really building at a fever pitch. I overhired to try to meet the demand. And once we started hemorrhaging money, that was bad. But it was a really interesting time for me because I was in my 20s. I was hiring a bunch of kids that were 20s, in their 20s. We loved every aspect of computers. We just lived and breathed it. Many times I'd come in on a Sunday when we were closed and there'd be like personnel just there playing with the latest video card or something. We were kind of a family, and we actually stuck it out. We were like tried to pivot, and eventually I just gave my stores to the employees, and I'm like, you know, I made my money. If you can ever like pay me back for the inventory, great. Yeah, if not.
How did that work out though?
One store still in business, Canby, Oregon. If you're ever in Canby, Oregon,
all right,
stop by Computers Made Easy, patronize them somehow over the last 25 years or whatever. They're still,
Wow.
I guarantee they're still there. I haven't been there in like 5 years. Little interesting side note. Now I'm like in kind of the world of, you know, business and startups. So I have some connections to like CEOs of bigger companies. So there were companies where they went gangbusters during COVID because everyone had to upgrade to put monitors and webcams in their home. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that tailed off, boom, out goes the CEO. Like, because line didn't go up anymore. Mm-hmm. So my little micro experience to that even applies to big corporations. So
like, you don't keep the revenue going. I just had a conversation half an hour ago with somebody who we're discussing about getting on the show. And her topic was unionizing the security force. All right. So not to get into too much of a difference, but my question to her was, okay, I'm trying to understand the value and things like that and how that worked. And it's like, well, you know, her assertion was the CEO is taking advantage of it and things like that. And like, okay, fine. Well, who hires the CEO? Who can fire the CEO? It's the board.
Well,
who hires the board? It's the shareholder. So ultimately, the shareholders can vote. And trying to say that's how you fix problems. If you go ahead and you get enough shareholders together to vote on a resolution and you change the direction of the company. And you know, we ended up agreeing to disagree. She thought that there was more activist ways to go ahead and create change. And I said, work it through the governance model. But you know, the point is it was a wonderfully civil exchange of ideas of somebody who looked at the world very differently. And I thought, this is pretty cool. Being able to go ahead and find people that look at the world from a different perspective, but are still respectful enough to allow you to put your ideas out, explore them.
Exactly.
And go, yeah, maybe not. That doesn't work for me.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, in the world of business, there's no one size fits all. Like that's, I've learned that over the years for sure.
But it's also figuring out what type of leader you want to be. Because,
and you know, associates I know that got like kind of collateral damage from COVID, like maybe, you know, it could have been some better communication to their board and like no surprises to the board, as they say. But who knows?
Yeah, boards do not like surprises. And again, you know, from the cybersecurity perspective as a CISO, it's one last thing you want to do is surprise your board. So, for example, I had a situation where I got hired onto a company and I got all the paperwork done. And they said, oh, by the way, you get to meet with the board. I say, fine, I'm good to meet with the board. And they said, oh, yeah, by the way, just before we hired you, we had a major breach. You get to brief the board.
Oh,
okay. Let's see how this one goes. Well,
awkward.
Awkward, but I did the homework, did the research, figured out what the problem was. It was a log4j problem in one of the libraries that had not been patched. Someone had a few lines of code to say every time somebody enters a credit card number, send a copy over there. Okay, whatever. So we get in there, change the code base, stop taking credit cards, go to authorize.net, go ahead and end up like the equivalent of an SBOM, you know, software bill of materials, so you know where the stuff is coming. Figure out what the liability potentially may be, what the filing requirements, Secretary of State, put all together and brief the board. Like, here's what happened. Here's why it happened. Here's the total cost. Here's the maximum amount of future liability. Here's the likely future liability. And here's why we won't have the problem again. And they're like, yeah, okay, we're good.
Oh my gosh. Now you're making me think of like times I have been adjacent to security breaches and problems. So maybe I have some stories to talk about.
Yeah, I think we all do. But the lesson I've learned out of that is that if you're going to be briefing executives, no surprises, bring them solutions and then demonstrate that what the potential ongoing risk is of your potential solution. If it looks like it's really worked in favor.
Big bullet points.
Yeah.
No blocks of text. You don't want them to be thinking about what you wrote on that slide. You want them hearing the words coming out of your mouth. Like that's one of my biggest lessons on you know, raising money or talking to the board is like, you know, it may feel a little, to me, it always feels a little patronizing to just have like a slide with like 1, 2, 3. Like, why do I even have a slide for this? But, you know.
You know, 5 slides, maybe 6.
Yeah.
But I don't go in there low with 35 slides to your 5-minute briefing. You're not going to get by that. But you mentioned about raising money, but before you were raising money.
Oh, yeah. Let me continue my story. I'm sorry. I'm getting long-winded. But, you know, so I did the race car thing, the computer store thing. It was all bootstrapped. I never went to college. You know, my computer store started failing. I had some savings, so I got a chance to figure out what I was going to do. And, of course, I always went to my dad, like my best mentor. What should I do? And every time I had trouble, he's like, go to school, get a degree, like get your life straightened out. And like, no, that's not my style. So I'd always been interested in electronics and inventing things, even when I had my computer stores, even though we were just slinging video cards and stuff. So I had built a bunch of things during that time, engineering wise, just for fun. I'm like, I'm going to go break into Silicon Valley. I hear this is where all the action is. So I started flying to Silicon Valley, finding every event I could go to, and I didn't want to spend a lot of money going to conferences, so I was sneaking in back doors. So these conferences, like Embedded Systems Conference and Silicon Now and whatever, and I would just walk around and just network as much as possible. So I would go to like all the booths and like, who looks like they probably are decision makers around here? And I'm like, I'd walk up to them, strike a conversation, do, you know, shake hands and like, oh, you know, get a chance to wedge in like, oh, well, I do engineering. Here, let me show you stuff. I always had a little duffel bag with me and like, well, here's a circuit board that does video encoding. Here's a circuit board that does like I/O. And that's how I ended up breaking into the startup scene here in Silicon Valley. It didn't have formal training, but, you know, as a lot of people find out, you can go to school, but actually, you know, on the job training is far more valuable.
There's the difference between making a professor happy and creating something of value.
And it was tough, like, and not too many people wanted to take a chance on me. My first engineering job was $12 an hour, but I took it very serious. I'm like, I'm going to do the best job I can. And I just killed myself, did a good job for them, which led to the next thing, to the next thing. And then after a while, I found out that I had this kind of reputation, you know, no one cared about my resume anymore, that I didn't have any like college degree on there. It's like, you got problems, go grab Jerry. She can assemble a team. She's a solid engineer, which, you know, over the years, I worked on a lot of different projects. I shipped, ended up working in the toy industry for a while, shipped millions of toys, worked on IC design. So like, if you ever had a TiVo, I was responsible for some of the chips inside the TiVo. I did navigation systems for low Earth orbit rockets, like really exciting stuff. Like, and, you know, in each step of the way, I found new mentors to help me along the way. Like, even in, like, electrical engineering, you have to come in with some gusto. When you're like, I can solve this problem for you, you start working with your client, and like, I know nothing about what I'm actually got to do. So then it's like, you know, pull in friends to either work with you or, like, give you the...
Or look for the dummy, you know, for dummies handbook and read up on that day before.
Yeah, and in recent years, I've started my own companies again, and that's been fun, and that leads to, like, some of these, like, being able to hobnob with, you know, high-level executives and hear their woes of, like, trying to keep that line going up and, you know, not, like, sticking your foot in it with security problems.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you got to your company. You were doing gaming stuff before.
Yeah, actually, I can tie this back into a security topic. So... there's a big video game company called Valve Software, and they have this platform called Steam, and they sell, like, by far the most video games on PCs than any other platform out there on the Steam platform. And they chased me for months, wanting me to come help them put together an R&D lab, and I just didn't want to do it because it's a software company. Like, there's a certain DNA in a software company versus, like, a company that builds physical products. And finally, they convinced me to come up, and it was a bit of a bait and switch, but they wooed me into the company. This happened to be the same week, and I probably shouldn't say all the details. So the same week, they lost all of their customers' credit card information to a person getting into a server room, plugging a computer into a server rack that came from the outside world.
Uh-huh.
I had nothing like directly related to it, except for I got to like see the fallout from it. One interesting thing, I'm like, this is going to be really bad for you guys, right? And everyone's like, you know, PR-wise, it's bad for us, because everyone was online like, screw you, I'm going to like delete my account. What I thought was clever and maybe savvy business thing is they immediately put up a sale on their front page. So when these people logged in, they actually found they made more revenue because people are coming in.
Whoa, wait, I want that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So actually revenues went up during this, which was pretty interesting. The second thing is, I think it was the FBI that was involved. So a bunch of like three-letter acronym people were all throughout the facility. And they were like taping off areas with like, do not cross this line. Like they took it very, very serious.
In the old day, they would confiscate the server. They don't do that anymore.
But yeah, they secured the...
You need to stay operational.
Yeah, they secured the... Well, I think they isolated some of it. Right. Like some of these servers like went off into a different room. I remember they like blocked it off and it's like, you go to prison for life or something if you cross this. And so I heeded that. But that's
probably good judgment there.
Yeah, yeah. You know more about that than I do. But I was just like, wow, what a first week or two. Like here, holy cow. Like, you know, mega corporation, you know, really stumbled over something bad here.
Yeah, so at that point, you're at Valve, you're doing video game development.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you've got some interesting concepts in terms of retro reflectors, but maybe I'm getting ahead of the story.
Yeah, yeah. So Valve, at the time, Microsoft was trying to close down Windows so that you could only buy software through the Microsoft Store. Mm-hmm. And so this was a direct threat to them. And so this is Windows 8 timeframe. And so they'd split Windows 8 into two pieces. There was like the Metro interface that would look like their cell phone that they were trying to do with a bunch of tiles. And in that environment, you could not buy third-party software. Then there was the classic side. And so they hired us to come in to give them an escape route, because if Microsoft was successful, they would have no business left anymore, because like 99% of their money comes from the revenue off of selling other people's games. Mm-hmm. So they're like, the founder of the company, Gabe Newell, he's like, you know, you have a simple mission. Like, I believe video games are too isolating between the different verticals. He's like, you know, you've got the classic gamers that played Pong back in the day. Maybe they don't play games today. You've got like the shooters, first-person shooter crowd. You've got the adventure game crowd. You got like young kids and they never really like play together. He's like, just go invent something that brings the whole family together in the living room. Mm-hmm. And so we had a pretty clear mission of like, how do we make like a family centric gaming experience? And it was like, that's how they lured me in. And I was like, you know, I'll take a risk on a software company if
you're doing
something that's meaningful. We didn't exactly achieve it, but we did learn a lot. So we spent quite a few years just doing research. We tried all kinds of things like input devices. We were like reading people's like brain waves and feeding it back into games and showing that we could make games more engaging, aka more addictive, you know, stuff like that. And I started getting excited about holograms on the table, like augmented reality. So video game characters, you just sit in the round and like a campfire, you sit around it and game characters pop out of the table. And I'm like, this is it. This is like, we had prototypes. We got a bunch of military grade stuff and we glommed together some prototypes just to prove it out. Like, this is compelling. Like young, old, gamers, non-gamers, we can make experiences that draw people in. Well, I mean, the Microsoft threat was kind of gone at this point. Microsoft Windows 8 was not, you know, working out.
It was not the best product ever.
So the pressure was off to like really double down on it. And they got excited about virtual reality and doing like what they're kind of accustomed to, first person shooters and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they ended up, there's like a big riff inside the engineering team. I'm like, tabletop AR, this is the way to do it. And like people were no VR shooter games. And they ended up like just taking everyone associated with augmented reality and just fired us in one shot. And so I had invented this retro reflective display technology that was really clever and low cost and solved a lot of problems. I don't have to go into all the details, but it was just clever. And so Valve has this really cool hiring and firing process that I like a lot. I actually do it in our company too. So if you hire someone, you fire them. That makes you think before you hire someone, like, I'm responsible for the entire life of this person, you know, inside the company. Like,
yeah,
wow.
Some wisdom in that.
That's cool. So Gabe Newell, the founder of the company, was the one that was going to fire me. So I'm like, the weirdest layoff process I've ever been through in my life is like, you know, I show up at the office the day we all got fired. Our mechanical engineer storming out of the building. They're like, did you hear what they did to an insert person's name? I'm like, what? They fired him today. I'm like, what? That guy's on my team. You know, I didn't even know what was going on. I go up to our floor and I'm like, charge in there. And they're like, well, you're fired and everybody else on your team's fired. So just hang out until you get the phone call to come up and.
But meanwhile, you have unrestricted access to your.
So it's like people filing in all day, like, oh, I can't believe they're, you know, and it was very strange and interesting. So we got access to everything. I also like got to see people like pulling stuff off my desk, like, hey, Jerry, are you going to use that like fancy oscilloscope over there? I'm like, okay. What in the world is going on here? So anyway, we went out to lunch, drank a bunch because like my time to talk to Gabe wasn't until later in the afternoon. And so anyway, I got myself all pumped up. Like I'm going to go give him a, you know, a talking to. So I charge into his office and I said something like, well, so this is it. And I'm trying to be super like alpha or something. And then I break into tears because I'm like really distraught that my like baby project is like... I go through all the ranges of emotions in about 5 minutes. And then anyway, they do the, you know, formalities. And then I'm walking out the door and I just like kind of spun my head around like, Gabe, you should just sell me that technology. He's like, okay.
And you got to take your invention with you.
Yeah. And another reason I can talk about this today and like, you know, executives that might be listening to this might be just crawling out of their skin like, holy crap, she's talking about internals of a company. Well, they had a separation agreement. Of course, they let me sit there all day and people were like separating from the company. They came back and like, well, you know, it sucks. I got fired, but they gave me this huge chunk of money. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up there and did the talk. Then I went to HR and they offered me a fraction of the separation money. I'm like, why are you giving me less than these other people? I'm like, well, those other people have a family. And I'm like, you don't know anything about my family. Like, work and family separate. Like, I'm not signing this. Mm-hmm. And there's a non-disparage and, you know, NDA and all kinds of stuff that on this. I'm like, I want something comparable. And they're like, hey, it's just free money. Just take it. I'm like, no. And so left the building, didn't sign the exit package. And then, of course, news gets out to the press, partly because I did a tweet. Like, sorry, executives, you got to be careful with disgruntled employees.
Yes. How do you tell when you go from gruntled to disgruntled? Well, the IRLs in your office get fired first.
So I'm a pinball collector. I have 80 pinball machines. So, of course, when I go to a company, they get the benefits of having really cool things. Yeah. So I had... pinball machines scattered around the office for people to play for free. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, F you guys, you don't get to play my pinball machines for free except for one machine. And I'll get to that story. I went and I disabled all the machines and folded the head boxes down, mm-hmm. except for this one machine that was slightly stupid. Like where I had the machines were next to the gym. And I have a female weightlifting pinball machine. So it's a big burly woman, mm-hmm. you know, on the back glass. Nothing like lewd about it. She's just a big buff woman. And people were like, oh, I hate that. That's the only one I left set up. They had to play the hard body weightlifting pinball machine. But so to continue the story, bring it back. I just put a tweet out, took a picture, like got fired today. And it was just a picture of all the disabled pinball machines. Mm-hmm. And of course, all the press reached out to me like, can you tell us anything? And I'm like, give me a day. So the next day I wrote back, I'm like, what do you think about giving me a comparable exit package? And they're like, you know, that's it. That's what we're offering. I'm like, okay. Oh, Gizmodo? Yeah, here, let me tell you about the Valve culture. And I actually just dragged them through the coals because they have this like mystique around them. They have this flat business hierarchy. So supposedly there's no managers, there's no leadership. Everyone's just all communal and doing the right thing for the company, which when it works, works great. And when it doesn't, it becomes junior high playground shenanigans, like people stabbing each other in the back. When you don't,
Lord of the Flies type.
It is very much. Another one of the employees there described it as, we're all lead guitarists with no drummers. So you can be chaotic at times. Anyway, I just started talking to the press. And then, of course, as soon as that started happening, like HR is like, what are you doing? I'm like, are you going to give me a compensation package? Nope. Like, oh, all right, you're stubborn about this. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I'm having negotiations with Gabe Newell about buying the IP. I'm like, this is never going to happen. I'm just raking them through the coals. No, I mean, he was a man of his word. He let me buy the technology.
Mm-hmm. And buy it with the money they were giving you from HR. He said, we'll call it even.
No, I never got that money.
Ah, okay.
Never got that money.
But you got the IP, and it was probably infinite.
Yeah, cool. I mean, I probably could have sued him. Like, the number of times that I'd been at companies where I like to be private about my personal life, mm-hmm. that I had to work over the holidays because, like, well, you don't have any family. I'm like, you don't know anything about my family because I'm not here to advertise, like, mm-hmm. what I do in my private time.
Yeah.
You know,
so you started your own business, and I remember you started with, you had a crowdfunding. Was that first raise you ever did?
Yeah, that was the first time I ever took external money. That was interesting. So this was when Kickstarter was brand new.
Mm-hmm.
You could put, you know, a brick on there and get $1 million. And so my co-founder, who was another Valve guy, we founded the company, we took the technology, we made some prototypes, we showed it a little bit public to prove that it was real. And then we did a Kickstarter campaign with a terrible video. We didn't know what we're doing. We're not marketing people. And we raised like $1 million.
Yeah, I think your original goal was like $450,000.
Yeah. Like, we could probably build like
you brought in $1 billion.
Yeah, but that was a unique time with Kickstarter. Like, the scams hadn't started yet. I learned a lot about like how stressful a Kickstarter is. So like, you do a crowdfunding campaign. Now you have like 3,000 people that think they're part of the experience of running a company. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly bombarded with like, you know, I don't like the color of the box. Like, why are you making the box this color? I don't like.
Contributed $29.
Yeah. So it's, I love them to death, but also it is a burden. And plus you have like thousands of people with guns pointed at your head. If you don't deliver this, we're going to slag you all over the internet. And like, you know, my good name is like important, you know. So that was like lots of ulcers over that. An interesting thing is we got so much hype going on this that immediately after doing the Kickstarter, we got a $15 million slug from an investor just like that. I'm like, man, doing a startup and raising this. Why is everyone complaining about this?
But you did something very unique.
Yeah.
I was one of those Kickstarter investors.
Hmm. Thank you.
You gave us our money back.
I did. Yeah. So an interesting thing, our new investors are like, you're dodos. You shouldn't like make the product that we promised. We want you to make this other product. Another valuable lesson I learned is like, stand up to investors.
You know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Investors are not the engineers.
They don't have enough situational awareness. A lot of times they'll come in and they'll like, and I'm like, well, I can't just like abandon all the Kickstarter folks. Like, we got to give the money back. And we did. We like, you know, here's your money back. And if the product comes out, you're going to get a free one. So we negotiated that with our investors. And, here's where some super valuable lessons come in. I learned 10 years of what not to do in a startup in like a year and a half.
All right.
So big money comes in, first time venture backed entrepreneur, but not the first time being an entrepreneur. Right. I did a lot of contract work. That's entrepreneurship. ran my stores, ran my racing business. I've been an entrepreneur the whole way through, basically. But I was scared. I had a lot of imposter syndrome. And so the investors are like, well, we're going to replace you as CEO. We're going to bring in some Disney and Sony executives to run the business for you. And so basically, I'm like, great, I get to go back to where I feel really comfortable working on technology. And it sounded really appealing at the time until we had these people that had really never run startups before coming in. They're just like, all right, we're going to blow $500,000 to rebrand the company because we don't like the name. Literally, like, it was so ridiculous. Like, it's a long story. I still have the books from that. It's a reminder of like how not to be stupid. Do you want to hear the story?
You're like, well, we still got 15 minutes left.
Okay, I'll do the story because I think it's, you know, if anyone's like in this position, it's kind of valuable. So we had a name with some recognition in the gaming space because we had like this explosive Kickstarter. First CEO comes in, changes our name. He does such a bad job and he spent like hundred some thousand dollars. It was a cheaper rebrand. And he didn't last long enough to even get like the website done or get the merch printed or get everything finalized. So new CEO comes in along with his sidekick. All right. He goes through, kicks off this, like it was about $400,000 with a New York firm to do it. And it was just so tedious. It's just like mood boards and just sitting around. Basically, they came back with a variant of our own name and a variant of like the design language for our product, which was basically the direction we were already going, like soft curves and white color. I'm like, I was so mad at the end of like, the final meeting, there was this book they gave us and the contractors went off and we're in there and like everyone's patting themselves on the back and I'm an asshole. I'm sorry. But I like picked the book up and just dropped it in the trash can. I'm like, we might as well have just put this money in the trash can and set it on fire. Like, and the CEO had these legendary walks that he would take me on, which is he'd get me out of the building and just yell at me. So I was
interesting management
in for a yelling. I don't know where I was going with that. But, you know, anyway, they burned through $15 million in like 8 months.
Wow.
And boom, crashed the whole company. Like just burned it all. Just burned every bit of it. So a group of us, we had been developing the technology. And it was working. So a group of us like, well, the story is I was by myself in the office with a sea of empty cubicles. We had 90 people hired at one point on $15 million. So I'm in the empty building. Of course, CEO's exited stage left and he's trying to raid the bank account for his golden parachute, which I went to the bank and helped them not do that, which he was very mad at. And then I got a phone call. So I pick it up and it's like, hey, it's Nolan. I'm like, Nolan? Nolan who? Nolan Bushnell, founder of Atari, found my phone number, had seen at some trade show our technology. And he's like, this is groundbreaking. Like, I've been watching what's been going on from a distance. I could see that this was going to happen a mile away. And he's like, trust me, I've screwed up a lot of companies over the years. He's like, I don't know how to tell you to fix this, but you know, there's always a way. Good technology always finds a way. And he said, just figure it out. So I got this pep talk from the founder of Atari, who I met like once. And I'm like, yeah, maybe. So I went to some other folks that were like really solid people in the company. I'm like, hey, do you think we could just buy this technology again and do it? And they're like, yeah, we'll do it. But you have to be the CEO and you have to like lead the company. And so we're going on year 9 after buying the technology. I went out with the black eyes of like making a $15 million crater in the ground, raised money, continually raised money, got our first gen product out. We got a second gen product coming out. I know I'm Osborne affecting myself.
Don't Osborne yourself. First generation's product is great. Keep buying.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's like we're still selling our first gin quite well, but yeah, there is a better one coming. Yeah, it's been good. And I've been running the company, and it's just like, some of the things I learned is say no to bad money. You know, there's been times, especially in the early phases of our company, where we're like 3 weeks away from going out of business. And like, of course, there's lots of these vulture kind of level investors. And they all have kind of the same playbook. Like, we'll give you this dab of money, but there's strings attached.
You're pound of flesh. You can't wire it.
Yeah, it's not only equity. Like, sometimes you can give up the equity and, you know, but a lot of times it's like, well, you got to put our guy in, or you got to give us a contracting fee to like manage you guys and be the adult in the room. And just my advice to, you know, entrepreneurs, just say no to that money and then just double down and just go find the good money. Yeah. And in my case, I got lucky, I guess. Like, I always found the money in time. But the thing is, I did another Kickstarter. So we got this first infusion for the new company. We got the product really looking good. And then all the investors were like, well, we need a proof point. And so they're like, do a Kickstarter. I'm like, oh God, not another Kickstarter.
Even though you're wildly successful on the first round. But as you said, you get a whole bunch of people in there like, how are things going? I want an audience with you. I invested $29. Yeah. You want, I need an hour with the CEO.
Love you. We love you. $29 backers. But so yeah, we got back from the quarter and we had to do another Kickstarter and we knocked it out of the park. For like we put, it was an all chips on the table moment for us. Like, okay, we had an investor, like, we're going to put this big slug of money into you. You do a Kickstarter. We want you to, like, you know, do better than you did last time and just prove to us that, you know, people want this. And I'm like, well, that's, people are going to want it. So we spent 3 months marketing and teasing, like, something's coming. And then I pulled all the strings I could. Like, the Gizmodo guy gave the exclusive on Valve, like, hey, I'm going to embargo you on a story. And, like, pulled all these strings and, like, lined everything up. Got everything teased, and then did some interesting things that can't say I invented this, but people guided us. We launched our Kickstarter at midnight, but we had gone around and got like interested people pre-primed to be there at midnight. So special perks and stuff like that. If you're there at midnight, but we did that on the down low relative to the press.
Right. Because they wouldn't see that.
But the thing is, at this point, there have been so many scams on Kickstarter. Like, the press didn't like to report on Kickstarters unless it was a sure thing. So we launched at midnight. We got something like $400,000 overnight. And so then when everyone woke up in the morning that was embargoed in the morning, and they woke up and like, holy cow, this, it looks like on Kickstarter, because we launched it at like 12:01 or something. That it's only been going in their minds for like a few hours and that it's already 400,000. So then all the press is like, runaway success.
Which then becomes its own runaway success. Yeah, there's the FOMO out there. I want to be part of it.
It's funny. Kickstarters and a lot of campaigns are like this. You make most of your video games are very much like this. You make all of your money the first couple days, and then it doesn't matter how much money you pump into it. You don't see immediate progress. So you flatline as far as sales through the month, but what you're doing, just screaming into the void, is you're lining people up that are going, in their mind, they have some kind of mental threshold of like, if it hits this much by the last day, I'll commit.
Right.
So you make like half your money the first couple of days, and the last half, the last couple of days.
And in the middle, just like a barbell, right? But just nothing in the middle.
Yeah, and then immediately we had a site set up. So, like, sorry you missed the Kickstarter. You can order here. So we had another, like, $800,000 or something dollars come in just boom after, just shortly after, all the people that just missed it. And like, well, there's still a chance for you. Not as nice as the Kickstarter.
But you still get something. So what happens then, in the Kickstarter, you're probably not giving away equity. I don't think you want to do that. But here's a product. Here's a little sample. Here's something. Here's a coffee mug with a logo on it. Kind of what it happens to be.
Actually, one of the things we learned from the first one is we had a bunch of like, get a sticker, get a coffee mug. We're doing none of that. We're like, if you just want us to succeed, you can just like donate some money, you get nothing. Mm-hmm. Like, because it took so much work to send a sticker, and like by the time you put a stamp on it.
I know I had someone who bought a Cecil Tradecraft hat because I'm on her website, and the guy said, hey, you know, how do you get a hat? He saw one of the instructors teaching that. He was at an event, and I said, well, here, go to the website. He bought one, and he said, I got one. I said, hey, you know, give me your address, and I'll mail you some Cecil Tradecraft stickers. And he sent me the address. He's like 5 miles away. He's okay. Well, I just, you know, I'm putting the envelope. And you're right. I wouldn't want to do that 100 times. But I thought this is
for 1,000, right? 1,000. Fine. I think we had thousands and thousands of backers.
Yeah, I think I still carry around a few stickers.
Do you?
Oh yeah. Look at that. I need one for my laptop. Get your stickers, folks.
Get your red hot stickers here in the last couple minutes of the show. The show's going to be ending soon, which means. Let's start wrapping up a little bit.
Okay, sorry I've been so rambly. Hopefully
that's wonderful. So a lot of lessons are you covered.
All right. Let me just complete the Till 5 story. Yeah. Still in business, selling lots of hardware. We're solving problems out there. It's been great. Like not being encumbered by like people dragging us in different directions and digging our heels in when we needed to, mm-hmm. and being compromising when we needed to. Like it's been very good.
So having a solid vision of your goal, knowing that you can get there, and knowing the roles that other people should play and should not play. Money plays a certain role, but it doesn't necessarily mean money can control.
I mean, there's all of these like analogies, and they're dorky, but it's like, get the right people on the bus and get the wrong people off. That is like, I'm still terrible at it today. Like, you know, we have a great team now, but you always get lured into like, you know, I'm tired of doing this task as a CEO. I'm going to like get somebody, and they're not very good at it. But like, it's better than me not have me doing it. It's like, no, just rip that effing Band-Aid off and get them out of there. Like, I've never had regrets of getting rid of someone.
And then the whole sigh of relief from everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
People more productive.
Like, finally, you got rid of that bozo. Like, why didn't you do that a couple of weeks earlier? Yeah, and it's a tightrope. I've seen it 1,000 times in different companies. It's like you got to be rigid enough, but not too rigid, and you got to like shed hats, mm-hmm. not too many hats.
Right.
So
eventually you figure out the cadence, but the thing is, over time, and that's what it costs us time. As I tell people, if all you got for your time is maybe just money or maybe just experience, okay, but if you get wisdom from that and it helps you do better the next time, it's a fair exchange, because yeah. We can't roll the clock back, but we can make better decisions going forward.
I mean, anybody can learn anything. Like you, yeah. You're a security expert. I could probably learn about security, like, but is it really worth it? No. I might as well just go like, yeah. Have you do it.
Right.
And like, just accept that I'm inferior when it comes to security. Or
no, you're able to better prioritize the best use of your time. So hopefully you've prioritized the best use of your time by paying attention to CISO Tradecraft. If you are watching us on YouTube, hello. If not, you're listening to us on one of our channels. We do have a YouTube channel. We also have a Substack newsletter, so you can go ahead and read about the stuff that we cover if that's a better format for you. And of course, we're on LinkedIn, and we do a lot more on LinkedIn than just podcasts. We have a steady stream of information. So let other people know where you're getting your insights for your career and for your security acumen, because we hope that you can go ahead and spread the news so you can help other people with their CISO Tradecraft as well. So Jerry Ellsworth, thank you for being
here. Oh, thank you. And you can find me on LinkedIn too. I always love talking to people. Yeah, you got to spell her right, J-E-R-I.
And find her on LinkedIn as well. And of course, I'm G. Mark Hardy on LinkedIn, as well as CISO Tradecraft. So until next time, thank you very much for listening, and stay safe out there.